All right, so I promised I would take questions. So you probably got a whole stockpile piled up because I keep promising this and I keep forgetting to do it. This is the part where there's a deafening silence and the comedian comes out and says, "Thank you, you've been a great audience." Right? Yeah.
One thing I was kind of wondering, you talked yesterday about how a space bank knew another space bank.
Yeah.
Could you expand on how that works?
Oh, you want to know what the actual mechanism is?
Yeah.
Okay, so, yes, but I have to back up and explain a small detail first. So in an ERAS process, and I think we will carry an analogous thing forward into Kyoto, so I haven't figured out exactly where it needs to sit yet. So the process sort of internally is really, in ERAS, an arrangement of nodes. And a node is just a short fixed length vector of capabilities. And the way we know the various pieces of the process is we know the address-based capability is supposed to live in a certain slot of a certain node. Okay, well, one of the slots is something called the brand slot. Okay? And a brand is just a capability that hopefully can't be forged. If it's going to be useful, it must not be forgeable. So, in particular, the constructor, every constructor has a brand that it uses, and any process that constructor creates, it sticks that brand in the brand slot for the new process. And that brand is unique to that constructor. In fact, in ERAS, it is a distinguished entry capability for the constructor that's not actually given out for any other purpose, and that's how we know it can't be forged, because nobody other than the constructor holds it. Okay. Now, the way we get the capability in the space bank case is by sort of magic initial... You know what? Yeah, is by magic initial construction. Okay, it's not using the same mechanism that the constructor is. But again, it uses every space bank holds a distinguished capability to itself. Okay, and that same capability is in the brand slot of the space bank. Now, it turns out there's only one space bank process. From the client perspective, it looks like there are hundreds or millions of space bank. They're actually all one process, and what the client actually holds is a capability to an object that we call a wrapper object. And this wrapper, in turn, holds an entry capability to the space bank. So this is the physical structure of the space bank capability arrangement. The way a space bank tests is it uses two capabilities. It uses this brand capability, and it also holds something that in ERAS is called the process tool. Now, the process tool implements an operation called identify. In Kikas, the process tool was called the domain tool, and the operation was called canop. Okay, so here's the protocol for identify. And there are two variations. So one is I have an entry capability, and I want to test, is this entry capability actually an entry capability to some process, to a foo process that is, say, one created by a foo constructor. And if I hold the brand and the process tool and an entry capability to a foo, or something that claims to be a foo, I can go to the process tool, I can present it with the entry capability and the thing I think ought to be the brand. And the identify operation will say yes or no. And if it says yes, it will actually, in the case of ERAS, will actually crack open the process and it will return to me a node capability. So this is actually a rights amplification operation. There's a long story about why this particular rights amplification operation is actually safe, because in general, rights amplification is not safe. Now, we weren't interested in the cracking part of this, we were really only interested in the yes or no. Now, there's a second operation which is structurally very similar to the first, which is if I hold a wrapper capability, and that wrapper wraps a certain process, and I think I've got the brand for that process, there's a similar identify operation that says, are you a wrapper to that other process? So now to answer your question, what the space bank actually does is you hand it, you're asking it to vouch for one of its fellow banks. Okay? So one of the arguments, you're going to invoke one space bank and you're going to pass it as an argument of a second space bank, or you think it's a second space bank. In fact, it's a wrapper capability. Okay? And the space bank is going to use its process tool and its brand, and it's going to attempt the identify operation on that wrapper capability. And according to whether that identifier operation succeeds or fails, it knows whether this bank is authentic. So, this is why, if I hold a space bank that doesn't actually let me allocate anything, so it's not giving me any storage, that's still enough to let me identify a second space bank.
So the way that a client is prevented from inserting sort of a delegate class, which most of the time forwards the calls, but some of the times keeps track of pages on behalf of the client so they can inspect them.
So should, some kind of front end on a real one.
Right, yeah. So that's prevented because it's actually cracking open the process and looking rather than...
We have too many hits. Can we be a little more specific?
The space bank is actually cracking open this process rather than...
Right, so if I were to hand you something that I said was a space bank, but in fact it was a front end to a space bank, right? It's just simulating a bank. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's even got a real bank behind it, but it's recording the traffic, right? You now would go to a real space bank, one that you already know is kosher, and you'd say, is this thing here a space bank? And it would attempt the identify operation, and the identify operation would fail because that other process is not a space bank. And that's how you would know.
Okay.
Now, let me say that the space bank in this system is one of the, it's actually probably the lowest level, most primordial piece of the system. So when you ask, how does the space bank do a function, very often you get an answer that's not the general pattern, because the general pattern requires some infrastructure that doesn't exist for the space bank to rely on, because the space bank is the infrastructure. Okay? So, the actual implementation of the identify operation, it's the same one that's used in the general pattern. But the general pattern is, I have a process, I have something that I believe ought to be the constructor for that process, and I can ask the constructor, did you fabricate this process? And there's a couple more steps, but the upshot of it is that the constructor also holds the brand for its yields, and it uses the identify operation in just the same way, and is therefore able to say yes or no. Yeah.
So, if the brand is a capability, what is to prevent me, as a misbehaving client, from handing my copy of your brand's capability to a random third party?
Okay, so there's more generally, the question you're asking is, why can't I change my brand or forge a new process using the brand that's sitting in my process state?
Right.
There's several parts of the answer to this. The first part to the answer to the part you asked, which is, why can't I just reuse my brand? Well, what you have to this is something called a process capability. If you attempt, and the process capability does permit fetch operations on these slots, although it does not permit as many as it did in Kikos, because we moved to, in Kikos, the way you would fetch registers is you'd fetch all the appropriate slots as capabilities, and they were number capabilities, and you'd crack open the numbers. In Eros, we replaced this with a get registers call, which made things a lot simpler. But even in Kikos, and certainly in Eros, there are certain slots you cannot fetch. They are write only if what you hold is a process capability. One of those slots is your brand slot. So you can reach in and overwrite your brand slot, Whereupon, nobody will ever believe that you're you anymore. Okay? But you cannot reach in and extract your brand, and because you can't extract the brand, you can't insert it in some other process. So that's the immediate answer to your question. The second answer, and actually I think in the original system, the brand slot was the only slot you couldn't actually read that way. And later I have a memory that I added another restriction, but I don't remember why. And it was a conservative thing. It wasn't like you strictly had to have it. It was just that it was so easy to get in trouble if you did it. There was no real good reason to do it. But the other thing is, this process tool capability, like, this is the authority to turn storage into processes. Okay? And in Kikos, if a process was sitting attempting to make a call, right, it would block on a queue if the receiver wasn't available. And in order to be blocked on a queue, the process state had to remain in memory. And there is a paper design that, as far as I know, was never implemented for something called a decongester, which is designed to sort of extract those processes out of the kernel, and the kernel becomes cluttered up. Okay. But there's sort of a hand-wavy argument about how the decongester works, but I'm not actually convinced that in a systemic sense it's actually a viable design. So there is a sense in which, even though they occupy the same storage, the ability to turn a node into a process gives you the ability to pin down a little bit of memory. Okay, there is a little bit of extra authority that that carries. And for that reason, and also because of the identify operation, the process tool is not a capability that is widely available. In fact, the only processes in Kikos that hold it are, as far as I know, the space bank and something called the process creator. And I've been describing certain steps, and I've been saying that these are steps that are done by the constructor. In fact, they're done by a subordinate to the constructor called the process creator. They should actually be done by the constructor or by the space bank. And in the next generation, this function is moving into the space bank. In Eros, the pin was reduced. Something has to sit on a queue, but it doesn't have to be the full process. And we've got a separate data structure that exists for the purpose of sitting on queues and being the smallest amount of memory that we could tie up for that purpose and still be able to reload the process. In Kyotos, we have actually, I think, got a decongester-like design that actually works. And it was not that it was impossible for the design to work, it was that there were details that, at least in the descriptions I had heard about the design, it seemed things had not been, you know, fully engineered out, and I was concerned about them. So to answer your question, part one is I can't read the brand slot, and part two is the process tool is a really hard thing to get your paws on. Right? Because it sits at the foundation of this identify operation, and the identify operation sits at the foundation of certain security contracts. And if we were allowed this to promiscuously run around, okay, there would be various negative things that could happen. Charlie Landau and I had a long talk about this. Our conclusion was that, strictly speaking, the process tool could be allowed to run around, but it made us really nervous, and we couldn't see a good justification for letting it run around. We couldn't really articulate why we were nervous about it. This is, you know, at the level of something itchy in the back of your head that says, now this really sounds like trouble, and I can't put my finger on why, but if I think it might be trouble, I'm not going to take a chance. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. I was going to start in today on how would I go about designing. I want to sort of step up, and so we spent a lot of time talking about kernel stuff. We spent a lot of time talking about details of certain mechanisms, and the problem is that I haven't done a very good job of gluing those mechanisms together. And you know, the thing that makes microkernel design hard is that you have a little piece here and a little piece there, and they hook up in a certain way to provide a certain kind of power that isn't obvious until you ask, how would I solve a particular problem? Or conversely, you go to solve a particular problem, and then all of a sudden it becomes obvious that you don't have, or you can't find, a way out. So what I want to sort of do is pop up a level and say, let's now start trying to design our way on paper through various parts of a system. And so I was going to start with a file system, and I realized there's a problem with starting with a file system, and it has to do with what decision are we going to make about persistence and our model for persistence. And there are three basic models you can take, hundreds of variations, but really three basic models on how to do persistence. The first is the one that we're all really familiar with from Unix. It says there's this thing called a file system. Okay. That's the thing that's persistent. It exists for the purpose of being persistent. Right? And we're going to have some naming mechanism and some permissions mechanism that allows us to refetch things from the file system. But processes and other kernel state are not going to be persistent. And we may or may not even choose to make the file system transactional so that it's easily recoverable. We might choose to do FSCheck instead. And that's the model we mostly use every day. And it's a model that is deceptively comfortable because we get away with it most of the time. But so observation, there is no way within the Unix API to correctly update the password file. Because in order to update the password file, you want to update both the password file and the shadow password file. And you want those to happen as a unit. Either both updates should happen, or both updates should not happen. And it turns out that there's just no way to say that in the POSIX API. It's not a transactional API, and its file system interface is not designed to be transactional. The unit of failure, the unit of potential loss, is the file. Right, that was the design choice. Okay, second option. We could say, well, yes, we would like the ability to save the state of processes, but we're not going to make that a system feature. We're going to make it the responsibility of processes to save themselves. Sounds disturbing, like truth creator, now that I listen to it. Okay, maybe I just won't go there. We're going to make it the responsibility of processes to save themselves and also to examine their relationships with other processes so that if it's necessary for multiple processes to save their state in some mutually agreed way, right, that they're going to negotiate this, they're going to do this one step at a time, one process at a time, and hopefully we'll find some way to restart them in a consistent way. Now, this is actually not uncommon. It's usually, as far as I know, done in large-scale supercomputer-style computation. And you do it for two reasons. Either you want to be able to, you have a process that's essentially a worker process that's part of some very large computation. You need, it's a computation that's going to run for weeks. You still need to be able to administer the system, and so you want a way to migrate the effort from one machine to another so that you can do things like shut down and restart the system. The other case is, you have a very good program, you have the possibility that the program will crash, and if it crashes after an investment of several weeks in work, you'd like not to use all of that work, 12 comes to mind, and so what you'd like to do is just periodically save the state so that you can restart it. This is a lot more difficult than it sounds to get right, because it turns out that there's a lot of process state that the process is relying on that the process is not actually entitled to inspect. Right. So, for example, there's all the state in your file tables. Okay, but there is state in the file tables that's actually very hard to correctly extract. It's not enough to say, what's the list of files that I opened? First off, their names may have changed. But having opened them, okay, so files at least I can reopen, and in principle I can use fseek before I shut down, and I could say, let me just seek to my current position, that'll tell me what my current position is. I'll save that, when I reopen the file, I'll seek to that position again. Okay. But stream connections, it's not so easy, right? If I'm talking to a terminal, the old state's gone. There's no way I can recover it. Now, that might not matter in the case of a terminal, because usually if I'm talking to a terminal, there's a human, and yes, there's been a loss of state, but the human sort of is in on the joke and knows what happened. But if I have a network connection to something else, now I actually can't save that at the kernel level of abstraction. I actually have to negotiate with the party on the other side of the network connection. We have to come to agreement that we're going to sever this connection in an orderly way, and that we're then going to restart it later. Right? That becomes now an application-to-application negotiation, and the reason it's an application-to-application negotiation is I can't do that at the kernel level. That new connection, when I rebuild it, is going to be a different connection, right, on which I am going to re-overlay the same logical communication. Now, the interesting case is, that's true even if the network connection is local. I can't talk to my neighbor on the same machine and shut down in an orderly way. Okay, the third possible architecture is to say, well, maybe what I should do is actually make it possible to save the entire system state. And then I don't have to do any of this at all. I still would have to do this kind of work for migration purposes. Right. But if what I'm after is recoverability, I don't really need to do this work at all. I'm still going to have to do it for network connections that cross a machine boundary, because my machine and your machine are saving at different rates in different kinds of time zones, if you will. But I don't have to do it in the local case. So what's the cost of that? Well, the cost of that is the kernel doesn't know what state is important. And let me be careful. Strictly speaking, it might be possible to implement this outside the kernel, but it's still very low in the trusted computing base. Whatever it is that implements this mechanism has no way to know which state is significant. So there's some stuff in your heap that you really care about. And boy, there's an awful lot of stuff in your heap that's just garbage. And in fact, most of the time, we weren't interested in saving the process in the first place, right? All the stories I told for when we want to save the process, these are exceptional stories. So if we got 100 processes running in the system, chances are good that we only are really interested in saving two of them. Well, if we start from the assumption that we're doing a Unix-style design, that's probably true. But if we instead were to say, we're going to assume this feature is in the system and we're going to build our processes to exploit it, we might actually discover the balance went the other way. I'm not sure it's going to be 98 and 2, but it might very easily be 85 and 15. Now, of course, the catch is there is that garbage state. And furthermore, systems don't crash all that often. So if we save this state very frequently, we're going to spend a lot of work saving stuff that we're never going to reload. And the reason we're never going to reload it is before the time that we would crash, which would be the reason we would reload it, we're going to have saved some new state. So all this work was throwaway. So there's overhead. The final cost is this style of design imposes restrictions on the architecture of the kernel. Okay. So far, all the things that I've told you about that are issues, I can also tell you stories and measurements that show that, yes, these things look like they're serious issues, but in actual practice, if you go look at the measurements, what you'll discover is, yes, you're saving unnecessary state. No, in spite of your intuitions, you're not paying for it. But the reason for that is very complicated. And it has to do with the way this system organizes its use of the disk. And it's not that you're not paying for it, it's that the I.O. is amortized in a different way. And if you took this stuff out, your I.O. actually wouldn't get better. On the other hand, The I.O. is much more efficient than you get out of the Unix system. The kernel architecture issue is a real issue. And let me explain what the issue is here. In order to save the state, we have to have a way, some of it is hidden in kernel data structures. In the case of the Unix file, there's a file structure, right? It has all this hidden offset information and permissions information that's been cached. And that's state that the kernel won't reveal to you. There's memory mapping state, okay? We have to have a way to get all of that state back out so that we can either rebuild it or save it. Hopefully not rebuild it because we've saved it. Okay. So there are actually two architectural consequences to this. One is that if any of that state is definitive, and what I mean by definitive is we actually need to reconstruct it. Generally speaking, I'm going to make a claim that in this style of kernel, there are two kinds of state. Like, one is definitive state. This is the state you really, really have to save. Okay. And the other is cached state. So this is state where it's based on some other state, and it has been reformatted or it's been rearranged for the sake of performance or implementation convenience, but it can be rebuilt. Okay, and under cached state, there are going to be two subcategories. Right, one is cached state that is read-only. We can just throw it out. There's nothing we need to write back before we throw this cache out. There are no mutations in the cache that we'll ever need to consider. Okay, and the other is the mutable case. So let me give an example of the read-only state. So I've talked about an address space model where I have sort of this tree structure, either paths or nodes, or the L4 mapping database. And separately, we have a set of hardware page tables. And ignoring certain optimizations that people are very fond of that turn out not to actually matter, all of the bit, you could, in principle, for all three of those designs, do an implementation where all of the bits in the page table are reconstructable from the node tree or the pat tree or the L4 mapping database. Okay. In fact, most of the L4 implementations don't meet that test, but they could. Okay. And if that's the case, you can throw the mapping tables out. You can literally go through the entire system and just find, hunt down every mapping table and just nuke it. With one exception, and this is an artifact of the Pentium, it's not a problem in the architecture. You always have to have one mapping table because it turns out that there's no way in the hardware to start a process that doesn't have a mapping table. So you need to have a placeholder mapping table where every user address is invalid. And in fact, when you nuke the page directory for a process, you have to reset that master address space pointer to point to this other placeholder table. But this placeholder table doesn't hold anything significant. It's just a patch on the hardware. So those tend to be read-only. The mutable case is, it turns out that the kinds of data structures that are convenient to write to the disk are not very convenient to context switch with. Okay. So I said in Eros, by the way, this is changing in Kyoto's because this data structure is really that horrible. In Eros, the state of a process is stored in a node. That means it's got to be formatted in capabilities, and that means there's overhead bits and type fields and all sorts of crap in the capability, none of which the hardware knows anything about at all. This is not the format that you want to be loading your state off of or writing your state to when you context switch. So what we do instead is we have a process table. Except that it's a cache, it's not the definitive table. And what we do is we take the state, put it in the process table in a better format, And we keep pointers back and forth so that when the time comes to clear out the process table, we can push it back to these nodes. The state of the nodes is definitive, but it may not be up to date. I understand I haven't gone through the details of that mechanism, but do you get the idea that there may be places where we can make a copy of the state, we might format the copy differently, do something interesting with it, and later we'll write it back. Okay. And that's just a cache. You can think of it as a software-managed cache. But because we have to write it back, it falls into this category of mutable cache. Okay, here's the cute part. At least in arrows, with one exception, and I'll tell you about it in a minute, all of the state that you would ever have to save, all of it, lives in nodes or pages. And those are disk data structures already by design. The kernel borrows that state for purposes of execution, right? Borrows in the sense of it sticks it in various caches. It builds various ancillary data structures to manage those caches. But officially, that state lives in a node or page, and officially, I can page that node out. I can remove it from memory. Sorry, I need to, when I say page something out, there's an unfortunate problem here that there are objects other than pages that we're going to move in and out of memory, okay? So when I talk about paging things in and out, I should emphasize that I'm talking about object paging and that not all of the objects here are pages. And I apologize for the confusing term. In principle, I should be able to take this node out of memory at any time. Except that, of course, before I do it, I better flush the associated cache. Now, what's the exception? Well, I said earlier, there's this problem that if somebody is blocked on a queue, right, eventually this queue is going to wake up and we have to record enough information to be able to set them running again. And that means that somewhere we need something conceptually equivalent to a back pointer from the queue to the process. And unfortunately, that list. Okay, so what are those? What state are those processes in if they're on the queue? Now I go back to my comments about why you want an atomic kernel design. In an atomic kernel design, if you are blocked on a queue, you have to be blocked on a queue before the commit point in the operation. Have to be. Because if you were after the commit point, then you would be halfway through an operation and blocked indefinitely. That would violate the atomicity requirement. So in fact, it means that if you're blocked on a queue, we know, in this style of kernel design, that if we were to take you off the queue and set you running, then barring interference from a debugger that might have changed your program counter, if we were to set you running, and assuming the rest of the system state did not change, you would end up asleep right back on the same queue. Because whatever condition blocked you before is going to block you again. Now, it might be the system state has changed. You'll try again. This time you'll hit some page that used to be there but now has been removed. And you'll need to get it back, so you'll block on that, and then you'll restart, but eventually you'll get back onto this queue, or maybe the condition that caused you to block will no longer hold, and you'll make progress, and that's what would have happened if we had woken you up. Okay. So it turns out that all these processes on queues, they're just running. We don't actually need to record which queue they were on. All we need to do is set them running again from their user mode instruction. They will find their way back to the right thing. However, in order to do that, when we save the system state, we need a list of what processes we're running. Okay, and a process that is receiving is not running. If I am waiting to get a message, Right? In the Eros design, I'm not in the running state. Waiting in Eros is not being on a queue. Waiting for a message in Eros is being a kid. Right? You're the thing that the sender is going to look for. In Kairos, it's not true. In Kairos, the process that's receiving is running, and it's got to be in the run list. Okay, I snuck something into that description that's actually important. The thing I snuck in is, if A is trying to send a message to B, that the flow of control in the system follows the flow of the message, and the flow of the message follows the direction of the capability. The reason that's important is when we go to restart the system, B may not be in memory yet, and A is going to try to send this message again. And before A can send the message, A is going to look at the capability and is going to say, in the kernel, we're going to say, oh, this is a capability to B. We need to get B into memory before we can send the message. So as long as all the pointers are pointing in the same direction, it's possible to ensure that we get everything properly paged in before we actually try to move the message. Let me show you the alternative design, which is the classic messaging design, and explain why it's a problem. The other option, or at least why it's a challenge, the other option is the endpoint design. The endpoint design says, there's a box in the middle, and A holds a capability to this box, the endpoint. And A is going to send, and B is going to receive. Now, imagine we're restarting the system. We're reloading everything back. A goes to send a message to this endpoint. What we would like to do, we would like to say, it would be good if somebody would be listening on this endpoint. Maybe somebody was. But we don't know who. We don't have a pointer in the reverse direction from the endpoint to the receiver. We probably did have that in the kernel memory because the receiver was queued on the endpoint waiting to receive. But when we pickled all this stuff to the disk, we didn't save that list because it turns out saving that list requires allocating storage. It's a very tricky thing to do. Fortunately, there is something else we can save that is equivalent. And the something else that we can save is when we save the state of B, if it is blocked on an endpoint, we can save the identity of the endpoint on which it is blocked. And now we can build an index, and we can say, I'm looking for somebody blocked on this endpoint, find me somebody. That's actually quite awkward. Because it doesn't scale well. It's fine if I have 40 or 4,000 processes, something relatively modest, right? But if I have 400 million processes, it's an open question whether this design will scale. Okay, so we have, I don't know, 5+ minutes, so I'm going to stop for questions. And on Monday, I'm going to start in on the question, how would I design a file system if I start from the assumption that I do have persistence? And furthermore, if I start from the assumption that I've got to be accountable for space, what does the file system look like? Okay, so that's topic for Monday. Questions? And by the way, I generally actually like to be interrupted. I hope that's clear by now. But okay, so questions about any of this? Not from the use order. You can never interrupt. We have this history in all of our documents in the lab of Swaroop exceptions, right? So Swaroop will come up with something that he's a little uncomfortable with, right? And we'll write a Swaroop exception into the document. And after a while, Swaroop realizes, oh, actually that wasn't so hard, and then we take out the Swaroop exception. So this is the Swaroop exception for the day. So, no, it's good, right? Because these are signs of learning, right? That, you know, things are confusing, and then they stop being confusing. This is actually a good thing. Okay, questions?
Maybe you'll cover this on Monday when you talk about file systems. But given file systems the way that I am familiar with file systems, right. When you write things to a disk, anybody can then come along later and read that data from the disk.
Why? So the suggestion is when I write to a disk, anybody can read it later. Let's set aside disk forensics, right? If I can physically remove the disk and take it home, and do a lot of analysis on it, or even a modest amount of analysis on it, unquestionably, what you say is true. And that's going to be true in any design we can imagine, and the solution to that is going to have to come from someplace else than the things that we've been discussing. And there are solutions, but those solutions are completely orthogonal to these issues. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to assume that disk is still in the system, and the rules when I go to read the disk are, I have to power up the system first, and I have to use the same kernel to try to read the data. Maybe an upgraded kernel, but I'm still running the same operating system. I'm not doing forensics. Right. Okay, go on with your question. So why do you believe anybody can read that statement?
Well, I guess if you're going to guarantee that you're using the same operating system, you may be somewhat safer. If you can, you have to somehow build in, if you are saving all of this state to disk and the state involves enough information to resuscitate these processes, like what capabilities they have and what is contained in those capabilities. If anybody could read those capabilities off the disk, then they would have power that they shouldn't.
Okay, so the information exists that one could do the forensics. Isn't that true in Unix as well?
Sure.
Right, disks don't protect themselves. Bits don't care who reads them. And if you want to solve that problem, right, you're going to have to encrypt the content of the disk. And furthermore, you're going to have to bootstrap that encryption from some piece of secure storage that's part of the local machine design so that when that disk is removed or when the wrong OS is booted, the crypto key is not available. Okay. And the cost of that is, God help you if your machine fails. And of course, you know, there are mechanically ways to deal with that that nobody in practice ever executes. Right? Yeah, sure, you can save your key, right? You can encrypt with a backup key, you have lots of things you can do. How many users are going to do these things? Zero, right? I can tell you my mother won't do it. So yeah, I mean, the data's there for forensics. Right? And anytime you step out of a system and take sort of a God's eye perspective on the system, you can do anything you want. But you're starting from a position that says, so if we step back and we remove all of the protection, we can do anything we want. And the answer is, yeah, we knew that. Okay. But here's the difference. In that Unix system, if I encrypt that disk, okay, and I boot up with Unix, I can still do anything I want. Because Unix can't defend the disk. The design doesn't let it. In this system, at least formally, in principle, if we boot up the system, we could defend the disk. And there's some fairly long amount of evidence that suggests that, and in fact, we actually did. I'm not going to claim it's perfect. I don't think it's perfect. I know how to beat it. I'd have to work at it. One of these days, I think I'm going to teach a course on, you know, covert channel construction techniques. Right? People think covert channels are just not a big deal. They are. Okay. The problem is, covert channels, they're not little dinky things, right? They're good for hundreds of kilobytes a second. How much of the database do you want me to export? And often, they can be achieved when the party transmitting doesn't even intend to be transmitting, right? So the lesson that we need to take away from some of the work on smart cards is, even if I'm really careful about designing a system to defend, it's often possible to observe the system's behavior from outside and draw correct conclusions about the data that the system manipulates. Right? So the story used to be, well, I mean, in the high assurance world, the story used to be, when I talked to people who built and evaluated high assurance systems, well, it's not such a big deal because actually, in order to exploit these channels, I've got to have a Trojan horse on the inside. I've got to have a transmitter. Okay, and if I don't have an intentional transmitter, then the amount of fuzz that I need to have to make things hard to observe is actually not really that big a challenge. Now, the problem is that that story now is revealed to maybe be wrong. We don't know anymore. Certainly it's got to be re-examined. So the story used to be, look, I can either keep out the Trojans or I can close the channels. Closing the channels is really, really hard. So what I should do is I should do a workman-like job just trying to minimize the channels, and then I should really focus attention on not allowing sensitive state to come into the hands of programs I don't trust, namely Trojan horses or some variation on that. And unfortunately, that story is now under challenge. But we're getting into a set of problems where nobody knows how to solve these problems, certainly not in the open literature, and in that particular one, I don't think even in the closed literature, the work is just too new. But the one thing I can tell you is, it's not interesting to worry about these it's not interesting to worry about covert problems until we solve the overt problems. If I can just walk into your house, right, and steal your money, why should I worry about hacking your bank account? That's work. Okay? I mean, it's silly. Okay. On the conversely, in systems where if we're actually able to achieve accountability and usability in the same system, I think it's going to turn out that we have a lot of the underpinnings to deal with the channel issues to whatever extent they can be dealt with. And the extent is unclear. But we're certainly not going to deal with it without this kind of foundation of resource management, or some kind of foundation of resource management. Okay, other questions? Yeah?
Can we assume that on a restart, we are going to restart all our processes again? We are considering such a scenario.
Yes. So the assumption here is that our goal is to have a system that logically runs forever. And occasionally we're going to lose power, and so, you know, on the real world clock, we're going to lose a couple of minutes, but we basically want to restart everything that was going on. So, yeah, that's the assumption.
So we are not considering the case where one of those processes actually brought the system down or brought it into a running state.
If one of those processes is the process that brought the system down, then we have a badly engineered system, because that shouldn't be possible. So how could it be possible? Well, there are two ways to be possible. The first is we had a transient issue. Okay, we had a bit rot somewhere. Or we had a bug. Empirically, and this is not a very happy answer, but so the bit rot issue is easy. If we reset the machine, right, the bits reset. The interesting case is the bug. So empirically, and this is not a satisfactory answer, but it's the best practical answer. What we observe is, when you restart all these processes, you completely scramble the order in which the state is reconstructed. It's actually very, very hard to reproduce this sort of corner case error when you restart the system. And in 30 years of execution, the Kikos folks never actually saw one of these things get reconstructed. And that's a real pain in the ass, because that means you can't find them and kill them. Okay, this is not a good thing. Yeah, and as to, you know, the process did something that was basically the result of a design failure and brought the system down, the answer is fix the system. And when the system is this small, that's actually not a crazy response. Because the kinds of things that can cause a total system failure, right, are all things that happen in the kernel or happen in the driver. In the driver case, they're going to turn out to be these corner case bugs. Or they'll be highly reproducible and you want to fix the driver anyway. In the kernel case, we're talking about a body of code small enough that it actually really is feasible with enough work that for practical purposes you can make a kernel of this size bug-free. And that's not, I'm never going to claim that that's generally feasible for software. And in order to substantiate that claim for this class of kernel, I'd have to spend some time walking you through code and pointing out why this kind of code is qualitatively different from the kind of code that we're usually engaged in engineering. But let me give you two data points. We know that the Kikos kernel ran uninterrupted in real production for 25 years. We know that that's not an isolated example. We know that the telecom systems in large-scale switches, that the design goal was 5 minutes downtime in 25 years, including maintenance, and that that design goal was met on every system that shipped. We know that flight control systems, the critical flight control systems, have similar or in some cases higher levels of assurance required in their design, and that by and large they meet it. Now, why? Because in these systems, this is the only design goal that matters and everything else is sacrificed to achieve it. And under those constraints, it can be done. And the people who tell you, you can't get the last bug out of a piece of code, I think they're probably right. Right? I don't know how to get the last two. But I know how to get all the others, and it's within the scope of what we know how to engineer to do that. In, under these very specialized circumstances. And that's an assertion you guys should challenge. Go dig into what's been done in the FAA level A systems. Go dig into the history of the telecom systems. You can find a lot of this stuff on the web. See if what I'm saying is wrong. And I'm sure we'll find systems where what I've said isn't true. God knows, they've shipped telecom systems that suck. The one in particular I'm thinking of was 5VSS. And there's a reason that every other switching system that's been designed since then has tried to follow the style of the 5VSS design. So you'll find counterexamples, but you'll also find examples that I think that support the statements I'm making. Now, let me qualify. Here's an example of a system that is that critical, that has that kind of robustness. Okay, the kinds of systems that are used for power control, right, large-scale power subsystems, okay, they're designed to run very reliably as well. The difference is, they were not designed to run reliably in the face of a misbehaving environment. It's not just that 5VSS stayed up. It's that 5VSS nodes stayed up when every neighboring node on the telecom network was misbehaving. They were actually designed under the assumption that they should not rely on their neighbors in the switching system to be well-behaved. Unfortunately, power systems were not designed with that assumption. Okay. So we also have to look what were the limitations or the scope of the design objectives when we ask this question. And there are two examples of switching systems. One was the New York fire, I think it was in the 40s, but don't hold me to that, okay, which took out the main switching station for Manhattan and caused a large, regionally large collapse of the switching subsystem. That was what changed their attitude about the requirements for engineering. And the second was the Chicago fire that took out the 5VSS node for Metropolitan Chicago. And I will claim that a fire is not a software failure. Okay. And the right question is, what happened to the rest of the network, okay, when that switch was physically taken out? And the answers were quite impressive. Even that switch operating in a building that was on fire continued to deliver service until the fire was put out for the vast majority of Chicago area customers. That's pretty crazy. And that was the standard of design for the Bell system. Anyway, that was a longer answer than you wanted. All right, more Monday.